You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We are the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Today is my last show before the holidays, and before I forget, we will not be having our regular 3 to 5 Friday show on July 5th for the simple reason the studio will be closed. People are taking their vacations along with the 4th of July holiday. So I decided to go along with it since I can't get in the studio either Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday of next week. So I decided that I will cancel the July 5th show that I had planned to have for the simple reason July 5th is the day the Department of Labor releases its unemployment rate statistics from the household survey and the establishment survey, which I initially thought was going to be released today. But when I didn't hear anything in the news, I double checked the Department of Labor Bureau of Labor Statistics site, and it indicated that July 5th was the date. So apparently the government bureaucrats will be working on the 5th of July, or at least some of them in the Department of Labor, to get the report out. And I'm very much interested in that because the reason why I thought today would be an excellent day, normally it's the last Friday, it's the last Friday of the month that the statistics are released. This month it was on the first Friday, and I was going to have that as complimentary segment to one segment that I'm going to be covering today, and that is the revision, or the third and final revision, to the real GDP numbers for May. For the first quarter of 2003 came out. And I won't hold you in suspense, but it was a little bit of a surprise to me. Just for background, the initial number came out at 2.5%. It was revised to 2.4%. And you got to understand, the advanced numbers are always, they're going to change, either up or down. So the fact that the second estimate revised down to 2.4 didn't surprise me, because I thought it would be somewhere between 1% and 2%. And I was surprised it was that high. Well, the third and final revision, which is the best revision, where they have complete data, revised the number down to 1.88%. And the reason why that's important, the U.S. economy is really slowing down. And what that means is our recovery, while we've had 15 quarters of economic growth, which is 60 months, which is good, has not been at the trend line number of around 3.3%. Most of the quarters have been in the 2 to 3% range. One or two quarters we had 4%, but over the last 2 years, the numbers have been either slightly above 2% or actually under 2% and close to zero. So I think we're still going to go into recession. It'll probably hit the second or third quarter. We will not be getting the advance numbers for the second quarter until the end of July. And again, you always have to be careful with the advance numbers, because they are going to be significantly changed, either up or down. But I'm fully expecting that the second quarter numbers, when they do come out at the end of next month, will probably see somewhere, if not somewhere between 0 and 2% is my estimate today. The economy is really slowing down and on the verge of another recession. And whether it starts in the second or third or fourth quarter, I don't know. It's anyone's guess. But it clearly, and that's why the unemployment numbers are important, because they kind of go, they in some ways reflect what's happening in the overall economy. But you got to keep in mind that unemployment rate numbers usually lag what's happening in the economy. So I'm definitely going to be covering that in our second segment. The first segment is a little unusual. The last two shows, I have gone over what the National Security Agency is doing, and in essence, what they're doing is invading your privacy. I was unaware, though, that there was a movie that came out in 1998 called Enemies of the State that really I would recommend anyone see today. And what's nice about it, if you go to my blog, which for the companion blog for this show, which is prankpops.wordpress.com, you will find at the very top the complete movie. I've embedded it in the segment, and it's a very, how should I say this, enjoyable, entertaining movie, but it shows you what happens when you become a target of the National Security Agency. Now, yes, it's a fictional account. It's a little bit far-fetched, but not. But what's important to realize, and I'll emphasize, this movie came out in 1998. That's why the cars look a little old. It's because it's been going on 15 years that the movie was seen in theaters, and you got to keep in mind technology is dramatically advanced. At that point, the internet was somewhat new. Now everyone uses the internet. At that point in time, you couldn't see videos online. Now everyone can see videos. So I'll relate that movie to what's happening today in segment one, but I want to call your attention to the fact that you don't have to go to a theater or even buy anything. You can go to my companion blog at prankpops, prankpops.wordpress.com, and look at the movie. It's on YouTube, and if you widen your screen and look at it, you have, it's about a 2.5 hour movie. The movie really moves fast, and it'll get your attention, and it kind of illustrates many of the points that I was trying to get across to you, is that many people say, you know, my life's an open book. I'm a law-abiding citizen. The National Security Agency would never target me. The problem is it depends on who's running it, and that's the point of the movie. People, you have a rogue unit within the National Security Agency that targets an attorney in Washington because they think he has a tape that would incriminate I'm not going to spoil the movie for you, but would incriminate them in some crime, namely a murder of a congressman. So I'll be touching upon that and try to relate it to the big picture, as well as update you a little bit of what's happening with the whistleblower that Edward Snowden that fled from Hong Kong and now is sitting in an airport in Moscow because he doesn't have a visa for it and is looking for another country. He's basically on the run from the Department of Justice because he released documents that were classified. And now you can look at the documents on. I've done a number of posts, not only for this show, but also on my main blog, which is Prank Palisades, which also is a WordPress blog. So you can get it from the Prank Pops at the very bottom. There's a link to it. The important point is that if we didn't have a whistleblower, we're only aware of what the NSA is doing or the National Security Agency is doing, because the whistleblower confirmed what many others have been saying. There have been a series of whistleblowers, and what's interesting is all of them, why the Department of Justice pursued him in the court, they never won a case. There's been, you know, five or six that they prosecuted, and they lost every case. Now, they were legitimate whistleblowers. Now, the Snowden, I think, is a little bit different because he has stolen documents and did not try to whistleblow in the traditional sense, because what he was telling the world, as well as citizens of the United States, is that the NSA has been spying on American citizens, all American citizens, and been getting all their data. And that's telephone conversations, all your emails, all your videos, any audio podcasts, for example, that you may have, all your financial records, all your credit card records, driver's license information. In essence, they're building secret dossiers on every American citizen. Now, my reaction is, just like many people, well, I am an open book. Most of what I have on the internet, I want the public to actually either listen to, such as this show, or watch. I have, you know, over 60 videos, mainly on art-related, French Impressionism, Vermeer. So they're educational videos. probably I have about 66, 67. I've sort of lost count. And I enjoyed making them, and people really enjoy watching them. Got a lot of feedback. But now the NSA has copies of all that, all my podcasts, all my emails. Fortunately, I really do not make many phone conversations or telephone calls for the simple reason I used to be in sales a while ago. And if anyone has been in sales, you are constantly on the phone, either prospecting or making appointments with clients and following up. So I had spent a lot of time on the phone, so I'm trying to get away from that. So my volume of phone calls is minimal, but other people make a lot of phone calls. And what you got to be aware today is that the National Security Agency is collecting all that information. They have the capability. They have they've built a huge data center in Utah, and in previous shows, the last two shows, I've given you a lot of information on that, a lot of videos. And for your new listeners, when you go to the prompopops.wordpress.com companion blog, at the very top you'll have links, and that's how you links to my shows, both this show and past shows, so you can listen to past shows. But right below that, you'll have a lot of information that I've gathered that when I prepare the show in terms of videos, charts, photographs, articles, reviews, anything that relates to a topic. Now, I'm selective about it. I deliberately do not include all the information. I include a lot of information because I tell people simply, I'm giving you information. I make mistakes. For example, last show, when I went back and listened to the recording of the show, I made a big mistake. Now, it wasn't intentional. I said that the unfunded liabilities were from $60 billion to $120 billion. Well, it's not. It's $60 trillion, where a trillion is a $1,000 billion. So I was wrong, and it was I basically misspoke. Now, in the context of the whole show, I corrected myself, but I make mistakes. People make mistakes. Most mistakes that people make are not intentional. I think most broadcasters, including myself, try to be as accurate as possible. But we do, on occasions, make mistakes and correct them like I'm correcting them now, because the real number was between $60 trillion and $120 trillion. And that's the unfunded liabilities for primarily Social Security and Medicare. And the reason why that's important is when you add those, there's a range and there are a number of estimates. A lot of people will use a midpoint of like $90 trillion. If you add then the national debt, which is approaching $17 trillion, you see there's no way the United States can ever, ever pay back the national debt and fund all those promises that they've made. Because when you're talking over $100 trillion, the GDP, for example, this year will be roughly about $16 trillion. In other words, that's the entire gross national product, all goods and services, final goods and services that the U.S. economy has produced. And another way to look at it, all the income that the United States has produced for the entire year. So to put it in perspective, you can see that the unfunded liabilities in national debt in total, whatever the precise number, it's of an order of magnitude of over $100 trillion. Which means that it's impossible, that promises were made that cannot be kept. And that's the reason why we have such huge deficits. We're paying, for example, for every dollar we spend today, a roughly 40 cents needs to be financed by debt. So I'm gonna first two segments. One will be on that movie and relating it to the National Security Agency. And I do recommend that you view it online. You go to YouTube to see it, or you can go to my segment zero. And the movie, again, is Enemy of the State. I watched it early this week. And, again, it's a really exciting movie. And part of it I went back to view for a second time. So I recommend it if you're trying to you're scratching your head, why should I worry about what's happening with the NSA? Because remember, the National Security Agency's primary mission is to, and I fully support him in this, is to counter threats to the United States from enemies of the United States, and those are usually foreign governments or their agents, and they initially, they're the organization that tries to break codes of foreign governments, decrypt it, and initially, and it's continued today, are responsible for intercepting communications worldwide. Now, what's interesting is they're obviously, as technology is as advanced, their capabilities have advanced as well as their funding after 9/11, and that's where the problem really got out of hand, when suddenly their capabilities not only were primarily outward looking, their same technology and techniques were then turned on the American people. And I think Congress needs to look at it and needs to stop this. I support the whistleblowers, because without them, we would not be aware what the NSA is doing. And unfortunately, many of the people that have led it, not all of them, have gone to Congress and lied to Congress about it. You know, bold-faced lies, saying, well, we're not doing this. Well, if you're not doing it, why do you have people? And this is in the last 10 to 12 years. Why do you have whistleblowers pointing this out? And when we look into it, we find out it's true. Whether it's Bush with his warrantless searches, or the Obama administration, now that's expanded the scope. And what you got to worry about is all it takes is an unscrupulous person high up in that organization that can turn their assets on you if for some reason you should become a target of interest for the NSA. So enough of an introduction. I'll be definitely covering that. Now I have two other segments, and this will probably be, I'm shooting for a much shorter show today, because of, well, not only the weather, but the fact that I need to definitely have this wrapped up by 5, and I got about an hour and a half to go. So the last two segments and is an area that I normally don't cover other than the highlight, and that's what I'm going to be doing today, is we had two major Supreme Court decisions this week. One involved the Voting Rights Act of 1965, in which the Supreme Court, on both of these decisions, initially you might have got the impression that the Supreme Court struck down the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It did no such thing. It did declare that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which deals with the formula used to determine which states and jurisdictions within states that are required to, if they have any change in their voting laws, requires them to seek and obtain pre-clearance from the Department of Justice. The Supreme Court, the conservatives on the court, and those are Roberts, Scalia, Alito, Thomas, I always miss one. Anyway, the 5 conservatives voted in the majority and struck down as unconstitutional Section 3, primarily because they made the point that the form that currently used to determine which states and as well as jurisdictions, or mainly counties within a state, if they have any change in their voting law, need to first go to the Department of Justice to get their blessing, get their approval. They struck it down because it was based on information that's 40 years old, and that what's happened in the last going on 50 years, it started in 1966, so we're in the 47th year of the Voting Rights Act being enforced. And I'm all in favor of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I have no problems with it whatsoever, because you did have rampant discrimination, primarily in the South, not entirely, but primarily in the South. And it took rigorous enforcement for several decades to reverse that. Well, what's happened is most if not all of those states today and jurisdictions within the state, now you don't have that discrimination. I'm not saying there's none, but the conditions are radically different. You've had over 40 years to correct the situation, and it's been largely corrected. And the problem that states were having, as well as counties were having, it's fairly expensive to go to the Department of Justice when they have changes. And let me give you some example of the changes. It could be like we want to change the voting place from on one street to another street, maybe 5 or 6 blocks away. Or we want to change the time of voting. Things like that would require Department of Justice preclearance. And the Department of Justice would approve a lot of the changes. Some they would not. But it costs time and money of state officials to do that, as well as time and money of the Department of Justice to look at it. See, I'm of the view that the Voting Rights Act has been a success, a terrific success. And that's why in 2006, when it came up to Congress, by overwhelming majorities, it was extended for 25 years. Now, what Congress should have done is what the Supreme Court, by its decision, is recommending, is you need to go back and reset that formula and based on new information and taken into consideration that for most states and most jurisdictions or localities, you no longer have discrimination, voting discrimination, primary race discrimination in terms of the voting rights of people. And it's about time that happened. And I think it's going to happen, but it's going to take probably another several years. I don't think this is immediately. What the Supreme Court did is sent it back to Congress and said Section 3 formula has to be revised, and it has to be that whatever criteria you're using has to be on current up-to-date information. And as a result, I think what will happen is fewer states and fewer either counties or localities within states will have to go through the expensive process of going to the what's called the preclearance procedures. Now, after saying that, you would get the impression, because immediately what happened, you had a very knee-jerk, I think a very knee-jerk reaction, primarily by what I call race racketeers, the NAACP being the primary one, but other people, that they were gutting the Voters' Rights Act of 1965. No, they let the Voters' Rights Act stand, but what they said to Congress is, you have to revise the formula by which is determined which states as well as counties or localities within states are still have to go through the pre-clearance procedure. So that needs to be done. Now, to be fair, when Congress extended the Voting Rights Act in 2006 for another 25 years, they held extensive hearings, and everyone agrees it's been a terrific success. I'm not knocking success, but you know, I'm of the opinion that most, not all, but most, the vast overwhelming majority of voting districts today, you're not seeing racial discrimination and procedures that are onerous on anyone. Now, I know if you live in Texas, Texas would like to have voter identification, which I favor for the simple reason I have a driver's license. I had to go to the motor, which I recently renewed. And finally got it after waiting about 88 days. You know, it was ridiculous. I was told at the motor vehicle department, the local one, it would only take 2 weeks. And they give you roughly a 60-day temporary license. Well, after 60 days, I'm still waiting for the license. And I actually had to write a letter to Austin to get it, which I think it's ridiculous. Now, I know what's going on. This is your driver's license, again, has become a national, de facto, a national ID. So I think what they do, and it's not me, I think it's everybody, they're being very deliberate about when they renew a license. They're checking you out, and I have no problem with that. But that slows it down for everybody, and that's really the problem. Because it's never taking me this long to get anything from the state. Now, it's a little bit of, but the reason I bring it up is what Texas would like to do, and some states already have this implemented, by the way, is when you go to vote, you have to show certain identification that has your picture on it. And one could be either your driver's license, or if you don't drive, you can go to the Department of Motor Vehicles in Dallas. They have several offices in the Dallas County area, and get an identification. I don't consider it onerous at all. Now, what you hear is that you have older people that this would be a big burden. Well, excuse me, most older people drive, and I include myself in that category. It's not onerous, and I show that identification. For example, I still use checks. So whenever I write a check, not all stores, but some stores require you to show your driver's license, and they take information off the driver's license and put it on the check. I have no problem with that. But other stores, you present the check, no problem. Some will run it through you'll actually get the check back. They've cashed it. But there's a lot of places where you have to show your driver's license, including stores, your library, for example, if you're trying to get a library card, if you're trying to prove your residency, for example, if you're going to go to college, that's one of the identifications that could be used, that the fact that you've lived at a certain address. And what you have to do is you have 30 days, if you should move within Texas, to update that address. So it is being used to track you. But it's also a means, as far as I'm concerned, it's a means to prevent voter fraud. For someone voting, either voting where they don't have it, they're either not registered or fraudulently registered in another name. So it's to prevent people also from trying to vote. For example, I go to vote and I find out someone else is already voted for me. Well, I have ID. I can prove it. But if you had identification, such as a driver's license, there can be other, it doesn't have to be a driver's license. It can be you need an identity card. Now, as a libertarian, I'm not really big on identity cards, but the reality is, and it's across the United States, your driver's license, for all practical purposes, is your identity card. It has your date of birth on it. It has your height. It has some basic information, your current address, your height, whether you have any restrictions in terms of I wear glasses, so I have to wear glasses when I drive. But it can do dual duty as far as I don't consider it unreasonable. The counter argument is, well, where's the voter fraud? And I said, excuse me, this is to prevent voter fraud. Well, you got to make the case for it. Excuse me. There are people that will register. We have organizations. One of them was ACORN, and this was in the news, and it's a big Obama supporter, by the way, that was prosecuted in several states for registering, making up names. Now, ACORN has gone out of existence and changed its name, but they were into, and again, illegally, getting people registered to the vote that weren't entitled to vote and engaging in voter fraud. Well, what Texas would like to do, and I think they're going to pass it again, is have a form of voter identification where you have your picture on it and some basic information. Some states already have it and request, for example, I was listening to the Secretary of State from Washington, who happens to be a Republican, which is somewhat odd because Washington, Oregon, and California today are primarily at the state level, democratically controlled states. Well, they've had identification system in place, no problems with it. And they also, in addition to photo ID, some form of legal, you could also use your passport, for example. you would have to give the last four digits of your Social Security number, and that way can determine whether or not you're, one, are you registered, and two, are you the person that you say you are? And I think that's a reasonable request to have to show either a driver's license or an identification if you don't drive, or your passport, something that's a government-provided identification that has your photo on it. It could be I was in the military, it could be your military ID card that had, again, has your photo. There are several alternative documents that can be used to identify you. It has to have a photo. Now, I'm, for example, at Richland College, every student has an ID card. And if the campus police stop you, they are well within their rights to ask for your identification card, which you should produce. And on at least one occasion, I did. I was asked. I showed them. Thank you very much. Just checking. And again, they're trying to prevent crime, and they don't want people that maybe have a criminal record being on campus. And one way to quickly determine whether or not you should be on campus is to produce your identification card. Now, that's not the primary reason most students have it. It's primarily used to check books out of the library, as well as to use the computer labs. So identification cards, whether it's colleges, whether it's military, whether it's driver's license, I don't think are a burden. Okay, yes, there are some people that are shut-ins, that are old, that are getting up in years. They no longer can drive. It is a burden to them. Well, there should be procedures in place to address that. But that's an insignificant portion of the voters. You know, I would say upwards of 99% of all the voters could easily apply and provide identification. Yet your progressive Democratic Party is the primary opponent of having a photo identification being required for voting. I think it avoids a lot of fraud when you insist on a driver's license. Now, I'm well aware that some people do buy driver's license for especially young people that cannot qualify, mainly to go drinking. But you also have people that are here in the country illegally that do it as well. So that's not a guarantee that you're going to have no voter fraud. But I think it would eliminate, you know, the small percentage of voter fraud you have, it would eliminate most of it, not all of it. You still need people at the polls to see that the voter laws of each state are enforced. So I have, and I might get a little bit more into the what the Supreme Court did here, but I'm summarizing. If you listen to my shows, what I usually do in the first hour is hit the high points of each segment. Now, there's not much more to say on the voting, but I'll briefly review it in the second segment, maybe give you a little more detail. The fourth segment today, I number, just for a point of information, I start numbering my segments 0, 1, 2, 3. So my fourth segment is segment 3 of the show. Is also on a Supreme Court decision that was released this week. And there were two cases. One was the Proposition 8 California case. And I'm just going to summarize that very quickly here. What happened in California is twice the voters, they have what's called, they can put issues on the ballot. And twice they put, and those issues can become part of the law or constitution of the state of California. And they were proved by majorities that defining what marriage is, and a marriage is between a man and a woman or someone of the opposite sex. What happened is you primarily the homosexual community has an agenda that is trying to get gay marriage or same-sex marriage as the definition. So they challenged the law that the people of California passed. And normally what happens in that situation, the attorney general of the state defends the law in the court. It didn't do it this time because the Attorney General, as well as the governor, were on the other side of this issue. So what happened is another party was willing to step in to the shoes, if you will, of the state. And initially that was okay, and they appealed it. Well, what happened is the Supreme Court, in essence, kicked it back to the state and saying that organization did not have standing. You see, in any legal dispute, the two parties have to have standing, and that's very, very important. And the lower courts decided that this organization did have standing. Even though it ruled against them, they said they did have standing. The Supreme Court said it did not. So it kicked it back to the state. And in other words, nothing really changed in California other than the fact that now that it's kicked back, what's going to happen is there's probably going to be another initiative on the ballot and probably more litigation. So they punted, in other words. And that's about as much as I want to say on the California case, because it really doesn't, if you don't live in California, it really doesn't impact you. The other case concerned the Defense of Marriage Act. And again, the initial impression that you might have gotten is the Defense of Marriage Act was, in its entirety, said to be struck down as unconstitutional. That is not what happened. What the Supreme Court did is Section 3 of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, was struck down as unconstitutional. And what the court was saying, and this involved federal benefits, that you cannot discriminate against gay couples that are same-sex couples that have been together, usually many years. You cannot, in terms of federal benefits, discriminate against them. And that, in essence, is again what the court held. Now, what you got to keep in mind is the gay community, especially couples, whether lesbians or gay men that are in a long, whether you call it a civil union or a marriage, a gay marriage, you would have gotten the impression listening to them that the Supreme Court had defined marriage or redefined marriage as extending it to same-sex couples. No, it did not. It absolutely did not. It only repeals Section 3, that you cannot discriminate against gay couples where, in regard to federal benefits. It did not change any state laws in terms of how they defined it. You know, every state has its definition of what a marriage is. And I have some information on the blog, and 38 states define marriage as between a man and a woman. In other words, a gay marriage is not considered marriage. It's that simple. And there's been no change. Now, there are some states that allow gay marriage and others that are sort of in between yet. And I have the statistics on that, and let me just quickly jump. And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but the point I'm trying to make is neither the Voting Rights Act of 1965 or the Defense of Marriage Act were not repealed. Only sections of each act were declared unconstitutional. Now, what was different in this case, it was, again, a 5-4 decision, but this time it was the liberals on the court that were in the majority. And Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, wrote the majority decision. Now, I brought the numbers up. There are 38 states that define marriage as a union of a man and a woman. Nothing has changed in those 38 states. Now, there are 12 states that can now force the federal government to recognize their redefinition of marriage because they allow same-sex marriage. There's one state where some sections of the Defense of Marriage Act have been struck down. The point, two key points. None of the state laws have changed as a result of the Supreme Court decision. The impact is mainly on who will receive benefits. And if you're in a same-sex marriage situation, now your partner, let's say you're the employee and your partner does not work for the federal government, can receive federal benefits. And that's about it in terms of what the impact is. Now, that's going to be, I'm not trying to minimize it. That's going to be expensive. It's not free. And, you know, some people think that's fair. Most people, I think, agree with what the states have, namely a marriage is considered a union between a man and a woman. That's the the overwhelming majority of Americans today believe in the traditional definition of marriage, and that definition has not changed. Because really, the primary reason for marriages is procreation. Now, it doesn't mean everyone that gets married has kids. Some people remarry, and they're much older and do not have kids. They might have had kids in their first marriage. Now they got divorced. They're in their second marriage. They're much older. They do not have kids. But the primary reason is that you want a marriage, a stable situation for not only having children, but bringing up children. And the overwhelming majority of Americans agree with that. What you have is you have activists, primarily homosexual activists that want to change that definition to include same-sex marriages. What I point out, and a number of commentators point out, there is nothing stopping someone that's gay and in a relationship like this of getting married. There are churches in the United States that will have ceremonies, and two men or two women can get married. Now, it's going to vary from state to state, but if you want to get married, guess what? You can. Because most marriages are performed by churches, synagogues, whatever your faith is. That's where most marriages, not all, but most marriages are performed. The issue, the kind of the nub of the issue is, okay, let's say you get married in whatever church that does this. Now, a lot of churches will not do it. Don't get the impression I'm saying all religions and all churches, all religions and all churches, this is an acceptable practice. But in most large cities, yes, you can find some religious faith organization, whatever, that will marry you if that's what you're looking for. But really the real issue is they want the states to recognize that. And the problem there is laws have been on the books for many decades, hundreds of years, that have defined marriage, the traditional definition of a marriage, as a union of a man and a woman. And the problem the gay community has is they can't convince the overwhelming majority of people in many states to change that definition. And until they do, they will not be getting certain benefits that couples have. I don't think, and see, the Supreme Court was not going to, what they were hoping for is that the Supreme Court would say that, would redefine marriage to include couples of the same sex. The Supreme Court did not do that. So portions of the Defense of Marriage Act are still in effect, the most important sections. And the court framed a decision is marriage is something that is the jurisdiction of the states. Every state can define it as it sees fit. And most of it, 38 states, it's a union of a man and a woman. That's the definition. It's not the union of a man and a man or a woman and a woman. So we're still going to have a lot of litigation both on the state level and federal level. This is not the... A lot of people were saying this is a so-called landmark decision. Very, very important case. I'm not saying it's not an important case. I think it is. But it's not as revolutionary or radical as some of the supporters of gay marriage are saying it is, because it isn't. So I might amplify a little bit more on that. I've really given you the highlights. Like I said, this is really going to be, for a change, a two-hour show. See, usually during the semester, if you're a new listener, my show is scheduled from 3 to 5. However, I have special editions of the show, depending on how much material I have, where the show will typically go 3 hours, especially during the regular semester, the fall and spring semester. So it was not unusual for me to have three-hour shows at all. And on occasion, I would go longer. I would go to 4 hours. After about 4 hours, my voice is worn out. And I have a little bit of a cold, and I can feel that my voice is going. So I'm going to alert you. I might cut this short because I've really highlighted and give you the kind of the takeaways from these four segments. So let's first go back to segment zero, which deals where I call your attention to the fact of this movie that came out in 1998 called Enemy of the State. It starred Will Smith and Gene Hackman were the stars. And it was about, I don't want to get too much in the plot, but the setup to the movie, or the premise of the movie, is you had someone in the a department head at the National Security Agency, NSA, was concerned that Congress was not going to pass changes to the capabilities of what the NSA could do. Now remember, this movie was made, produced, and released prior to September 11th of 2001, and that's important. The NSA has been, for many, many years, really decades, has a real close association with the telecommunication companies in the United States. Many years ago, you only had one, AT&T. Now you have many more. Yeah, today you have, for example, Verizon and other providers. I don't use either one. And I was talking to someone last night, and we were comparing notes as to how much it costs to have telephone service. And I said, well, you know, I buy every 2 months, I buy a card, a prepaid card that gives me 60 days of service and 300 minutes. And because I make very few phone calls, I've accumulated many thousands of minutes. But to continue it, either every 60 days, it's 60 days because I buy a $30 card. So it cost me $30 plus the taxes that go with it. So it's around $16 to $17 a month for me to have a cell phone that I prepay and I accumulate unused minutes. Now I have to pay for any incoming call or outgoing call. It's going to cost me 10 cents a minute. Now I know there are places you can get it cheaper, but most people that had the reason I got rid of my landline many years ago, because I looked at, I've been using AT&T for years, and I saw the bills, and they more than doubled in over a 20-year period. And I used the phone a lot more then, but very, very few of the phone, most of it was local, which you pay a basic fee, and it's covered. And then if you had long-distance call, that was an addition. But I noticed that it more than doubled, and that really drove me to buy this cell phone because it's costing me, in essence, half what a landline is. Now, why am I getting into this? The National Security Agency, the NSA, today has built a huge data center. And what's stored in that data center is everyone in the United States phone. Every phone call you've made is stored there. Not just the metadata about the length of the phone, the duration or length of the phone call, and who called you and who you called. It's more extensive than that. Because initially, many commentators were saying, well, what's the big deal? Any phone company has to have billing information. And the metadata is, in essence, the billing information that telephone companies have to collect. For example, if I make a long-distance phone call, they have to know how many minutes, who was it to, and to determine what should be the bill for it, depending on what type of plan you're on. What many commentators did not pick up is the Edward Snowden and the gentleman that fled the country to Hong Kong and now is in Moscow released to two newspapers, The Guardian in Great Britain, United Kingdom, and The Washington Post. He released 5 top secret slides that I have posted on my blog. They're embedded in the blog, of a top secret 44-slide presentation of a program called PRISM. And this program has been in place probably since 2003. It says they started to go to certain companies such as Microsoft. It gives the years. There's a chart that gives the years that they went to what they call a provider, such as Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, PayPal or PayTalk, YouTube. They went to these providers to get all your emails, all your videos, all your audio, your podcasts, for example. Google is another one, and it gives the years. And what are they, and a chart above it or a slide above it says, okay, what did they get from these companies? Your emails, your chats, your videos, your photos. If you ask any private investigator, one of the key bits of information they would like is a current photo. Where can you get a current photo or fairly current photo? State driver's license. That's why when you go to get your initial license or renewal, they take a photo. Now, if you're young, usually your driver's license is good for, I believe, 12 years. If you're older, 5 years. But they want a photo. They want any of your financial records, any files that you've transferred. Let's say you're FTPing your files to a provider that you've entered into some kind of contract, and they're storing them for you. Any video conferencing that you've done. You get the idea. All this information is being stored at several databases across the country on every American citizen. Not just the enemies of the United States or threats or targets that the NSA is targeting, trying to get information on. In other words, now every American citizen's private information is being stored in an NSA database. In addition to that, they're storing all your telephone conversations. And they obviously get that from Verizon, AT&T, all your telecommunications. And what they're doing, it's not really a wiretap. Most of your communications today go over fiber optic cables, and that's for your internet. But also you have telephone switching, and many of the phone calls abroad go through the United States. You know, you might, if you were, let's say, in Europe, you might be making a phone call to someone in the next. Let's say you're visiting Paris and you're calling a friend in Berlin. You might think that the most direct way is, you know, Paris, most physically shortest distance. That's not how it works, especially on the internet, because those cables might be busy, so they'll reroute it through the United States and back, take the fastest route. And that's what the slide is saying. PRISM is dealing with, in terms of the companies, your Microsofts, your Googles, your Yahoo, your YouTube, PayPal, and they're getting information that those providers store. And that could be, again, your photos, your video, your emails. And they're storing it. Now, why is that dangerous? And this movie points it out. Should you, for whatever reason, become a target or get on a list of targets, at that point, an NSA analyst, together with a database specialist, will build a file or dossier on you. They will retrieve this information and look for connections. Who are you talking to? Who are you seeing? And in the movie, and I'm using this as an example, they go after an attorney, and they want to know, first, who was he making phone calls to? So they, okay, let's sort it in terms of number and frequency. And it was a woman that he had an affair with when he was in college or in law school. Ah, well, let's target that person as well. And what they found is the lady was receiving periodically cash payments that she was depositing into a bank. They had the bank records of both the lawyer, the male lawyer, as well as his previous girlfriend. They were and that's what happens once you become a target. And they were looking for what's called leverage. That's a polite way for something dirt that they can use on you to either blackmail you or force you to do something. And that's why I'm recommending this movie, because it shows you what could be done then. Now, there's a lot more to it. I'm sure if you're on Richland College campus, but in any major store. See, I can remember when, not too long ago, stores and campuses did not have cameras everywhere. That's not the case today. And I, for a short period of time, I was helping out someone that was trying to get a business off the ground, and they sold surveillance cameras and the recorders for them, as well as these magnetic doors. And I would go to businesses and walk the business. And most of the businesses already had alarms. And these were fairly large businesses. Not all of them. Some were small, but some were quite large. And what I would do, and I usually went out with a technician, that the person that actually had to install it would walk around and determine what was the best position to put a camera, both in terms of the outside and inside. And for small businesses, that typically was 4 to 6 cameras. A large businesses, it could be dozens of cameras, and there are different capabilities of these cameras. Some of the more sophisticated cameras would enable, I forget the name of it. Oh, the type of camera, and these cameras are many thousands of dollars. Usually a guard in a room looks at all these cameras, and these special cameras, and we have them on Richland College campuses, by the way. Has a joystick, and he can zoom in. He could direct it to someone of interest and zoom in. And, you know, you also can set it up where the camera will, you know, zoom out. You see a distance and then do a patrol in the medium range and then close up. You can pan it. In essence, what you can do, you can pan it and tilt and swivel the camera. And you can do this with a joystick. So if something suspicious is going on, your security guard or your police force, for example, with very large parking lots, can direct the camera to where he thinks something's going on. But at one time, none of the campuses, for example, on DCCD have them. Now, virtually all of them do. And they're not all these what are called, you have two basic categories of cameras. One is overt cameras, and you've probably seen them. They're these round or... they're usually dark glass, gray dark glass, with a camera in it. And you don't know exactly where it's pointed. But they're usually, the reason why they're overt, it's telling people you're being recorded. Now, those are fairly easy to spot on this campus. And they're usually, when you walk into a building, you'll see these dome cameras. The building I'm sitting in now has them. The mistake some students make, not me and not some other smarter students, that's not the only cameras, for example, that are on this campus. You have another category of cameras, covert cameras, and they can be, an example, in a clock, in a thermostat, or in a smoke detector. I'm sure you've seen on campus these cone smoke detectors. And what they are is a combination of a smoke detector. Are they a smoke detector? Usually they are, but also they have a camera in them. And you'll see them in front of elevators, in front of entrances to offices, elevators, even all over the place. You know, primarily where you have value, you know, for example, computer labs, in front of the entrances to the computer lab, in the hallways. You know, if I walk out the door of the studio, there is one of these cones, and I know there's a camera in it. And the same thing, we have a lot of computers in a lab across the hall from where I'm broadcasting this program, and there are two doors, and guess what? Nearby are those smoke detectors. Well, yeah, they're there. They're doing two things. Should there be a fire, it'll detect smoke, but it also has a camera. Now, where do all these cameras, what's happening? Two things are happening. One, it's being recorded on a hard drive, like, you know, recording your television programs, same principle. You have a big hard drive, and it's taping it. Now, usually what happens after a couple of days, it varies depending on how large the hard drive you have, as well as really how long you want to keep these tapes, because what it'll do when it runs out of hard drives, it's going to overwrite material that, let's say, you collected a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And it's going to vary. So that's first thing. just like the NSA's doing, you have colleges, you have businesses, you have churches, everywhere you go. If you go to, there's a branch of the Dallas Public Library not too far from where I'm at. They have cameras all over the place. Now, not too long ago, you didn't see these cameras. They're the way I like to say it, the price of these cameras have gone down, down, and down. And so is the storage. It still costs you money. And part of the reason you have a camera is prevention. That's why you want overt cameras to warn people. Listen, if you do something that's not, you shouldn't be doing, you're going to be recorded and you might be caught. Now, the problem you get into is some of these cameras are very, very good and some of these cameras are very, very poor. And you can't make an identification on them, but some you can. You know, for example, a camera that I love to sell, you know, some customers wanted to be able to read license plate numbers. They might have a fleet of vehicles, and they want who's going in and who's going out and when. You need a special camera to do that. Can capture that license plate number, and that had to be a higher quality camera to do that. So what all these cameras do, there's a conduit with wires in them. A conduit is like typically it's aluminum piping that takes with inside of it you have a wire that's connecting the camera to the DVR. That's going to record that's going to record all this information on a hard drive. And when you're talking a big facility like this campus, you're probably talking, I don't know the exact number, but I'm willing to bet it's upwards of 200 plus cameras in all over the campus, both overt ones, and they tend to be the round ones, and on the corners of your buildings high up are those swivel cameras that I was telling you about, those pan, tilt, swivel cameras. They're covering the parking lots. And that's a safety and security feature. Because I can remember one day, this is many years ago, I was walking from one building to the other, and I heard a woman start screaming, help, 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 in a real huge parking lot. And this is in broad daylight in, let's say, I don't remember the exact time, but, you know, let's say about 11 or 12 o'clock. It's not at night. And it took at least 5 minutes for the police to respond. Not anymore, because they have these more sophisticated cameras that are covering the parking lot, and that is for students' protection and safety. So it will cut down on crime, because while a lot of criminals are stupid, your smart ones, once they see those cameras up there, what's going through their head is, hey, listen, if I rob a vehicle, take a vehicle, there's going to be a recording. Because what these cameras are typically set up, they will do a patrol. They'll zoom out, and then they'll pan. They'll zoom in and take a medium range shot and pan. And then they'll do a little closer and do the same thing. And you set them up to do that. So they're recording all that information. In addition, you'll have either on-site, for example, with this college on-site, you have the police have several people monitoring all these cameras. They're seeing what's going on. And you also have software that can alert the officer or guard that something unusual has happened. You see, you have your screen will be divided. Typically, depending on the size of the screen, you might have 16 or as many as 32 cameras, maybe even more. It's been a while since I sold those cameras. And what happens is the software can pick up what it's programmed to look for patterns that are unusual and alert the officer. You need to look at camera 71. There's something happening on 71 that you should look at. And that's important because humans miss things, especially when you have to monitor and scan 16, 32 cameras or more. They'll cycle through. Now, once you see something going on, you can either touch or click that camera and get it full screen and then get more information. And what happens typically, let's say someone is being attacked or assaulted, an officer can be dispatched to check what's happening. Now, why do businesses, colleges, churches, charities, governments do this? mainly to save money. Although it's very expensive to install these systems, it's still less expensive than to have one or more guards or police officers patrolling. Because remember, you got to pay them the regular pay, retirement, and benefits. So one officer or one guard sitting in front of a monitors can cover a lot of area that before you would have someone walking a set patrol, if you will. You know, I remember one large chemical company that they already had several cameras, and for a lot of reasons they had to have a lot of security, but they wanted more cameras. And I asked, well, why do you want so many more? They already had a fair number. And it's very simple. We don't want to pay the salary of two people 24/7. What we want is more cameras on our facility so we have total coverage. And then we want someone remotely monitoring those cameras. You know, that's what they were interested in. And they had the money to do it. And they put pencil to pen and knew that they could save. It's two employees that they didn't need. Now, yeah, they have to pay for the cameras, the recorders, and yes, you're going to have people in a central location monitoring it, but that was cheaper than having a dedicated guard or police force on site. Now, why am I telling you all this? At one time in the United States, you didn't have this at all. Technology has advanced. Camera technology has gotten better and better and better, and smaller and smaller and smaller. The storage that records this has gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. You know, last Saturday, I needed to buy some flash drives. And I may or may not tell this story last show. And I bought two 16-gigabyte flash drives. You can put it in a pocket. At one time, you couldn't put that in a pocket. That was a room, a big room. What's happened is storage has gotten cheaper, but it's also gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And let me put it in context. I bought a hard drive. This is many years ago, at least 6 or 8. And it was the size of a brick. Think of it as a fairly large brick. And it stored 750 gigabytes. That's a lot of data. Now, why did I need that? I had some very large photographs as well as videos that required that storage. It wasn't for Word documents or PowerPoint slide presentations. And that's what you got to keep in mind. If you're storing video or storing a lot of photographs, especially large, high-resolution photographs, which I was doing, these were big files. I needed 750 gigabytes. And I had to lug around this hard drive and put it in a box because you don't want to drop it, because you drop it, you might lose everything. Well, as I was shopping for these flash drives, mainly to store my radio shows, by the way, prior to that, I did a little research online and found that I could get a portable, I underline that, portable hard drive, external hard drive, about the size of an iPad or an iPhone today. A little bigger than a pack of cards, but not much bigger, and about the same thickness. Guess how much that hard drive stored? 2 terabytes. 2 terabytes. That's 2,000 gigabytes. That's almost 3 times what that brick stored, that heavy brick. And this was a light and small, and it had 3 times the capacity. And guess what? It was cheaper than that brick that I bought. I say cheaper, not much. Now, I didn't buy it. Why? I didn't need it, but it was $160 retail. And I saw online, and there was Amazon was running a special. You could buy it for $140, no shipping, no taxes. 2 terabytes is a lot of information. And that would store a fair amount of music, videos, podcasts. In essence, I won't say it will restore everything that you do in your life, but that's a lot of emails and a lot of videos, a lot of music. What's happened is the price has gone down, the size or capacity has gone up, and it's also been miniaturized. Now, where I'm going with this, and why am I giving you these examples? You got to keep in mind you have innovation in technology, which gives you more capabilities. And that's why one of the consequences is, literally, you can't go out in public today and not be on camera. If you're walking around this campus, you're being recorded in the hallways, not only when you enter, but all over the campus. And usually, assuming you're doing nothing wrong, after a couple of days, that whatever tape you were, whatever camera and wherever in the hard drive it's stored, that is erased. Because it is expensive to keep it for, if you want to do it forever. That would be prohibitively expensive, and schools and businesses don't want to do it. They'll keep it for typically several days, a week, in case something comes up. Let's say there's a robbery and they notice it, then they can go back. Well, it was kind of funny when I was working for this firm that were selling these surveillance cameras, and they had them on their, obviously they had them in their facility. They recorded a break-in. Now, it was only after the fact that what happened is two people broke into the adjacent business, but were captured on our cameras, and the police came, and they were trying to get an identification off the camera. The problem is those cameras are not, at least the ones we had, it would be hard to get an identification off them. Yeah, we could see roughly what the person was wearing and who they were. You get that idea, but it's like watching a black and white TV. Today, you can get colored ones. They're more sophisticated. It all depends on how much money you have and what you're trying to do. Because like I said, most of the businesses that I approached, all of them had burglar alarm systems. That's the first thing. That's prevention. What the cameras do, or largely after the fact, not entirely, but largely after the fact. Because what happens is, and I would tell my clients this, or potential prospective clients, you put these cameras in and you might have a theft. And not all the time, but more than half the time, the person stealing from you is your own employee. Maybe your most entrusted employee that's unaware that there's a covert camera looking at him when he's stealing whatever he's stealing of value from your business. What stuck in my mind, one client had a lot of copper that's expensive that was used in the processes of the product that he used, so he had to have a lot of copper on hand, and he was concerned about that because if that walks out, that's that thousands of dollars walking out. So I made a point to tell them, most employers, what happens is they become very, very disenchanted when they find out their most, what they thought their most loyal, trusted employee was the person stealing whatever items that they were trying to protect. But it's after a lot of them, it's after the fact. Others, for example, on this campus, you have both elements. You have prevention, and that requires people actually sitting in front of monitors and looking at it. You see, your typical business installation is not looking at it. They're just recording it in case there's an incident that they can go back and look at the tape or look at the monitor and see what was happening at a certain time. And one of the capabilities is you can go back, you tell which camera and which date and look it up. But keep in mind, depending on how much storage you have, after a certain period of time, what happens is it's going to be overwritten. And that depends on how much storage you have and what you're trying to do. Every situation is unique and everyone has their budget. Now again, why am I telling you this story? That's what the National Security Agency is doing. They're storing all your information, and no matter what form it is, no matter what form, photographs, videos, emails, phone conversations, chat, PayPal, your credit card transactions, and yes, they can get access to these cameras, and they can also get access to the databases that are running these organizations. Now, what's the problem with it? It's called the Fourth Amendment. This is something that they should not be doing. It's violating your rights of privacy from unreasonable searches and seizures. And that's why I strongly recommend that you view this movie, Enemy of the State. And I entitled this segment, Life in imitating art. And keep in mind, the capability is now much, much greater. And what really led to what many have called the surveillance state that we live in is 911. Because suddenly a lot of funding became available to universities, to colleges, to government departments to put in this security. It's not just cameras, though. It's not. You're being watched. You're being monitored. And yes, you might be, your book, your life might be an open book. You might be a saint. You have nothing to hide. I feel that way, and many Americans feel that way. The danger is, once this information is collected, and it is being collected, the danger is you have to trust the government. And I do not trust the government. Because if someone gets in power that wants to use this, and believe me, it has happened, is happening, and in the future will happen. They use this technology, this stored information, and remember, today we live in a digital world. It's all zeros and ones. What I'm broadcasting today is saved as a file as zeros and ones, and it's transmitted over the internet to where I store my podcast, as is the blogs, the segments. My blog posts for this show is all zeros and ones stored over the country. Now, I want it stored. I truly do. And I want people to watch my videos and listen to my podcast. And many Americans are in the same position. However, there is certain information, and this is true of everyone, that they consider private. Your financial records, what you're spending your money on. Yet all this information is being collected by the NSA. And if you ever become a target of someone that, let me jump what you got to keep in mind. Right now, congressional oversight committees are looking at what the IRS did in terms of targeting Tea Party organizations, pro-life, pro-Israel, pro-constitution, pro-fiscal responsibility. They target those individuals for more scrutiny and delayed getting the... What was happening is organizations were set up and they wanted to get under the law, under a section of the Internal Revenue Code 501c4, they were entitled, if they met certain criteria, for a tax exemption. And in order to get that, they needed a letter of determination that they qualify. These people obviously have a political point of view, and there are people on the other side that have an opposite point of view, and that's the danger. Once this collection of information on you exists, and it is, it exists, and it's getting bigger and bigger every day, it can be used to target you just like this attorney was targeted, and the people he was associated with was targeted. And what's interesting about the movie, this attorney, like many attorneys, hires investigators. And the investigator that he hired just so happened to work for the National Security Agency for many years and developed many of the technologies, the microphones, the tracking. And that's something I didn't mention. You're being tracked. If you have a cell phone, whoever your carrier is, they have to know where you're at. So you're being tracked. And some cameras have applications that people aren't aware of that are taking photographs of them. I didn't say you're taking the photo. When you have your cell phone out, it can take photographs. You're not hearing the click. It can take videos. It can take photographs. Whether you're in your car, in your home, at school, whenever you take that out, assuming it's not covered, it can take photographs. And guess what? Those photographs are stored. So if you become a target and they're wanting to know where you're at, what your home looks like, what your place of employment looks like, where do you drive to the extent that you pull out your phone and you could be taking a call or making a call, it can be taking pictures of you. Now, I'm not trying to get you paranoid, but those are the capabilities that exist today. And this can, and unfortunately, I hate to say this, probably will lead to tyranny. It's way out of hand. Yet, the media is not really emphasizing this. I listened to the coverage of this whistleblower. A lot of the attention is where the whistleblower is, and he's a traitor. We need to get him back. Now, why, you know, I have a term, the bigs, the big interventionist government status. It was the bigs, the status, your not only your politicians, but mainly your politician. We need to get this guy and hang the traitor. Why were they reacting that way? This gentleman did blow the whistle. And I think he was smart doing what he did, because he saw what the NSA and the Department of Justice and the FBI did when they went after these legitimate, totally legitimate whistleblowers that work for the NSA, that were trying to make Congress aware of what was happening within the NSA. You see, the bigs, the big interventionist government status, do not want the American people aware of what's going on. This is fundamentally embarrassing on them, because this was kept close. Primarily your chairman of your Senate and the House Intelligence Agency, intelligence committees, as well as judiciary committees, as well as the leadership of the House and Senate. It was highly restricted, and they could not talk about it to their own colleagues, the privacy of every American citizen has been totally and completely compromised. This should be a major story on all your networks. Are you seeing major stories on this? You're not. No one's connecting the dots here. Yeah, there are a few cable channels. I have videos. To the extent that there's video coverage of this, I think I have most of it, not all of it. And I've given you some YouTube videos of whistleblowers. Like this segment has several of them. One of them is Bill Binney, who worked for the NSA for 32 years and developed this technology and this capability. The reason why he resigned, and this was right after 9-1-1, is he developed it to go after foreigners that were spying on the United States, that were threats to the United States. But what he was seeing in the Bush administration is that same technology, that same capability, was now being directed at the American people. And I only became aware of this movie, and when I did, I said, I was surprised that it was not mentioned nor emphasized. Because the problem is, you really got to show people, and a movie is a good way to do it, the capability of the NSA. And I cheerily by accident, I was reading. I do a lot of reading on a lot of subjects, and I've been reading that when this movie came out, that the head of the NSA, an Air Force general, Hayden, was aghast when he saw the movie. It didn't portray the NSA in a good light, but it did, I think, an excellent job of showing some of the capabilities at the end. And it's frightening. It is frightening, should you ever become a target, what they can do. And again, that was 15 years ago. The NSA couldn't do in 1998 what it can do today. Remember, in 1998, cell phones were quite large. Now they're small. And very few people have them. Now almost everybody has them. Almost everyone has them. And now you can carry around a 2 terabyte external hard drive that's about 2 decks of cards in size. And the only reason I'm giving you that example is, okay, cost you money to do that. It's not free. But the NSA has been given millions of dollars, and they built these expensive data centers to store all this information. And Bill Binney, one of the whistleblowers, he hasn't worked for the NSA in over 10 years. He resigned or retired from it and whistleblew, was trying to get Congress's attention, and went to several committees with other people trying to tell Congress what was happening and the dangers of it and the threat to privacy. So I urge you to watch that movie and become aware. You are living in a secret security surveillance state. I call it S4. A secret security surveillance state. And it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. And what Bill Binney said is, That data center, and I have a nice picture, it's a huge data center, right above the Prism, which is the project that did this, has the capability of storing all that information that I listed, not just for the American people, but for the entire world for 100 years. 100 years. There are over 7 billion people in the world. And 100 years is a long time. That's a lot of emails. That's a lot of videos. That's a lot of photographs. That's a lot of podcasts. And yes, there are some parts of the world that are very undeveloped and don't have what the technology that we have in the United States. But even in the poorest countries, you usually have cell phones. And some people have computers. And you do have either landlines or cell phones. That's being captured. And the extent that you have computers, your emails are being captured. You see, that's why they got upset about him. I'm glad he blew the whistle. You see, I suspected all this. Like I said, I've designed databases. I know the capability. All it takes is resources and money. And what happened after 9/11 is Congress was throwing money at the government, especially the NSA. Protect us, protect us. And that's always used. And the threat is always used so you will give up your liberty for some security. That's always the trade-off. The culture of the NSA was you don't spy on Americans. That might be the culture in the past, but when you build this capability and capacity and have stored this information, it will be used. It's only a matter of time. I think it's already being used, and it can be legitimately used. That's what's the hard part of this whole situation. I think it's fair game, for example, that any illegal aliens that are here in the United States be tracked, because we have a lot of people selling drugs, engaged in crime, as well as potential sleeper cells that could be activated by foreign governments, as well as terrorists. I'm fine with setting secret dossiers on potential targets like that. What I'm not fine with is using this capability against the American people. And I hope a public conversation and discussion begins, because this leads to tyranny. It leads to tyranny. You're relying on the good intentions of the people in power. And let me tell you, folks, in any organization, it only takes one or two people, rotten eggs, however you want to call them, rotten apples, whatever, that can use these capabilities, this information, and target people for whatever reason, whatever reason. And many times, national security, that'll be the reason. Well, potential national security. That's the excuse. Sometimes it's legitimate, many times it's not. So yeah, they're trying to crucify and get back into their hands Edward Snowden. Now, he supposedly, well, let me back up. One part of this movie, and again, I'm going back to the enemy of the state. The person in the NSA says, we want to discredit this attorney. We got to release information to the newspapers that should he have this tape, he can be discredited. And that's what they do. You know, besides, you know, he has credit cards that suddenly he can't use. Suddenly in the paper appears articles that are untrue. As a result, he loses his job. So when you get an unscrupulous person, and guess what? They're in the government. They're in industry. They're in government. They're in education. And it only takes one. And if he's in a position of power and has access to this information, he's going to use it. Or she's going to use it. I think it's already been used. And they will rationalize it, give national security. He's being investigated. What they're trying to dig up is dirt. They're trying to get leverage on people. Sometimes for the simplest reason, to shut them up. And that's what they were doing with the Tea Party. That's what the IRS was doing. They knew by delaying and delaying and delaying these determination letters that these organizations would have less money to get their message out. And they didn't like the message. And that's why the IRS went after these people. And we still have not gotten to the bottom of it as to who in the IRS or in the White House was quarterbacking or leading this operation. And believe me, the IRS is kid's play compared to what the NSA can do in terms of its capabilities. Watch the movie the enemy of the state. Now, the second, I'm looking at the clock, and I need to wrap it up in the next few minutes. So I'm only going to touch upon, I've really covered the Supreme Court, the two segments on it. I was maybe going to add a couple more comments or opinions on it. As far as the two, I am really, how should I say this, on both opinions. We elect representatives to pass laws. The court should not arbitrarily, and I really have some problems with both of these decisions, where judges make law, and that's what they should not do. Their primary function is to interpret it, and where there's conflicts, resolve it. But they should not, out of whole cloth, make laws. And that's where this Supreme Court, whether it's the conservatives or liberals, are guilty of it. I mean, that's my concern, and that's my summary of those two decisions, especially the Defense of Marriage Act. It's very, very tempting. You get one more liberal on that court, and I think the Supreme Court will say it's perfectly all right to have same-sex marriage, and they'll define marriage as a union between not only a man and a woman, but a man and a man and a woman and a woman. That'll happen, and that's the one I'm somewhat concerned about. Now, I'll summarize the second segment. Is we're going into a recession, and we're seeing a slowdown. When we got the revision number of 1.8%, that's not good, folks. That's slightly half what the average growth rate of the United States is. And when we get the unemployment numbers next week, and it'll be the following week before I give you, I think it's going to confirm that the unemployment rate has gone up. Because when the economy slows down like this and the growth rate is heading towards zero, remember, a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative growth. So we had hardly any growth in the fourth quarter. 1.8 was definitely better than the fourth quarter was 0.4, and I have a chart at the very top that shows the quarterly rates, and you can see, yes, the first quarter was an improvement because the fourth quarter of last year was terrible, under 1%. This is under 2%. But the general trend over the last 8 to 10 quarters is the rate has gone down, down, and down, and the average is around 2% or less. We're heading directly for another recession. Our economy is stagnating. And in next week, I'll get into the implications of that in terms of higher unemployment rates. I think we're going to be going back to over 9% and probably over 10%. I fully anticipate sometime in the next 1 to 2 years, we're going to see another recession. Remember that usually the so-called recovery began in July of 2009. That was 4 years ago. 4 years ago. Usually you have a recession every 3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years. Sometimes it might be 6 or 7. Sometimes it's less. But most of your recessions, after you started on a recovery or expansionary phase, start within 3 to 5 years. We're 1 year away from that 5-year limit. And I think what we're seeing right now, and you saw with the Bureau of Economic Analysis, they're part of the Department of Department of Commerce numbers, is the early signs of going into a recession and much slower growth. And I also give you some background information so you can see it in past years, what the quarterly information is and where the recessions are. We really have not recovered. We've not hit the peak of the last expansion. This is by far the worst recovery since World War II. We're at least 12 million jobs less than what we should be doing. I'll really amplify that on our next show. Again, it won't be on the 4th. It'll be on the following week when I'll summarize what happened in terms of the unemployment situation and what needs to be done about it. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We are the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. I hope you enjoyed today's show and have a good holiday, 4th of July. Be safe, though, those firecrackers. Go to a professional show, because those firecrackers, you know, I know kids play with them. I played with them, but they're dangerous as a kid. Don't lose an eye or a finger because of a few firecrackers.